In celebration of Black History Month, there is a new book by a University of Massachusetts professor that overturns long-held assumptions about the abolitionist movement. The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, is by Benicia Sinha. It's published by Yale University Press. In the book, she shows that rather than being composed of white, bourgeois, racially paternalistic reformers, abolitionism was a radical movement of women and men, black and white, slave and free, who supported feminism, labor rights, and utopian socialism. Relying on extensive archival research and newly discovered materials, The Slave's Cause explores the influence on abolition of the Haitian Revolution and slave resistance, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Benicia Sinha to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I remember seeing you on C-SPAN and thinking this is a fascinating topic and something that is really something that I wasn't even aware of. What brought you down this road to explore this grassroots idea?
Well, I wanted to write a book on African-American abolitionists, and there had been work done previously on them, but I was very interested in looking at the influence of slave resistance in the making of American abolition. And so the book project really began as looking at enslaved and free African-Americans in the movement. But then I realized that in order to fully understand their presence in the movement and their influence on the tactics and program of the movement, I had to actually look at the abolitionist movement as a whole. And so it became a kind of a broader study of an interracial radical movement which centered the roles of African-Americans in it.
So when you begin and you think of a timeline and a frame, you wanted it to begin where?
That's a great question. I was actually going to concentrate in the sort of classical pre-Civil War period of immediate abolition.
Right.
And looking at black radicals and then at William Lloyd Garrison and others who which began the abolition movement in the antebellum era. But I realized that that I needed to extend the chronological boundaries of my work. And I worked my way back to the 18th century, even into a little bit into early modern Europe, to really trace the roots of the abolition movement.
And through those roots, what do you learn?
Well, the one thing that I learned was this notion that we have that African Americans were not really part of the movement until the sort of second wave of abolition, of immediatism and Garrisonian abolition, is false. That right from the start, black activists and writers played a central role in the emergence of abolition. And then I looked at the influence of something like the Haitian Revolution. While a lot of work has been done on the Haitian Revolution, not many scholars have looked at its influence on the abolition movement. But most contemporary black and white abolitionists viewed the Haitian movement revolution as part of their movement. So I was able to uncover, you know, other events and other aspects of the movement by going back further in time and making a case that interracialism is something that characterized abolition right from the start, even though the early abolition societies tended to be predominantly white.
I used the term in the introduction of a radical movement. Why is that not, or why has that not been the thought all along, and why does this differ so from the notion that we have been told and taught over these centuries?
Yeah, well, most historians and scholars who look at the abolition movement, either sympathetically or even unsympathetically, tend to see them as very much part of the sort of mainstream growth of liberal democracy in this country. And I sort of differ a little bit from them by arguing that abolitionists tended to be far more radical in their views, and that not only did they champion an end to slavery, but many of them took up the cause of women's rights, advocating the rights of working people, Native Americans, coming out against nativism, just being part of a far more radical and alternative worldview than most historians credit them with.
And in that worldview and thinking of this radical movement, it makes sense. It makes more sense that way, doesn't it? That those who are oppressed, those who are dealing with this, would rise up to change what is happening.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons why people talked about abolition is this sort of bourgeois white movement burdened by paternalism and economic conservatism was because they really had a whitewashed understanding of the movement. They wrote out the presence of African Americans completely. And I think if you, one, include the diverse nature of the movement in terms of women's participation, the participation of African Americans, and two, by looking at the connections that abolitionists forge sometimes with contemporary radical movements, including the early labor movement, you get a very different point of view.
How conscious were the people, the radicals, if you will, who were behind this movement, how aware were they of what else was happening around them?
That's another great question. I think abolitionists really did try to situate their movement, especially in the 19th century, with looking at other international radical movements. So many abolitionists, for instance, like Garrison himself, was very sympathetic to the principles of utopian socialism, sometimes to early feminism. They took part in the early peace movements, the early peace conventions and congresses that were held. Both black and white abolitionists were part of those movements. And even though they weren't able to forge a formal alliance with the labor movement in the United States, they were, at least the Garrisonians, were able to do so in England, where they formed an anti-slavery league with British Chartists, which was, of course, predominantly a working class movement geared to get working men in Britain the right to vote. So I was able to see these connections, these transnational connections that I think other historians had ignored.
Hmm. And the radical nature that has so often been ignored. And what was the coverage, if you will, if that's a proper word, the coverage of those radical acts at the time? Were they dismissed?
Well, not really. If you think about the fact that the 1848 and 1849 revolutions in Europe got a lot of attention in the United States, and the abolitionist reaction to it was also extremely favorable. But abolitionists insisted that these movements should not simply be movements for national liberation, that they should also include a radical agenda, like many leftists and radicals at that time felt. So you see Garrison, praising Mazzini and entering into a correspondence with Mazzini. You see them forging alliances or at least publishing the works of, Russian liberals who are fighting against serfdom. But they really do see the dawn of the 1848 revolutions as part of the growth of democracy in the Western world. So the rise of free soilism, which is a political anti-slavery movement, was linked by many to the European revolutions of 1848. And when the Hungarian patriot Lajos Kossuth came to the United States and refused to endorse the end of slavery, Garrisonians in particular, but abolitionists criticized him and said that his humanity or his love for humanity should not be narrow, that it should not be narrow patriotism, that it should cover all of humanity. So you can see these direct connections, and a lot of this is covered in the press at that time. Kossuth's visit to the United States was a huge affair, mainly because Southerners were very wary of what they call European Red Republicanism infecting America, but also because abolitionists tended to be tended to support these movements, and political anti-slavery figures supported these movements too, but they wanted European radicals to be part of their cause too, to condemn the existence of slavery in the United States.
In my reading of the book, one of the things that I made a couple notes on that I just am curious about is the relationship between those who were enslaved and their allies. And this goes to a very basic question of, how do you know they're your ally?
That's an interesting question. I actually uncover direct links sometimes between, of course, enslaved people and abolitionists. And I uncovered instances of abolitionists being inspired by instances of slave rebellion rather than vice versa, which is what slaveholders said. They said, you know, our slaves are content and happy. It's these outside meddlers and fanatics who are creating this unrest. I found the influence going the other way. So, for instance, Elizabeth Herrick, who was a Quaker abolitionist in Britain, she issues the first call for immediate abolition in 1824, and her pamphlet is reprinted in the United States by abolitionists like Benjamin Lundy. What I found interesting about her pamphlet that historians had actually referred to earlier was that towards the end of the pamphlet, she has an appendix in which she defends the Demerara slave rebellion, clearly showing that the source of her inspiration were the enslaved themselves. Then I looked at, someone like Garrison, who's a pacifist, you know, committed to nonviolence. And then you see how he actually defends the Haitian Revolution, even though he's a pacifist. He sees, you know, he has these imaginary dialogues between the leader of the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture, and George Washington that he publishes, showing Louverture to be the true revolutionary because he had gotten rid of slavery in his country. So I saw those connections between slave rebellions and the growth of abolitionist radicalism. And then, of course, in the United States, what becomes really important is the fugitive slave issue and the fact that so many fugitive slaves become abolitionists. So I actually have a chapter in my book called Fugitive Slave Abolitionists. And of course, right. We all know Frederick Douglass,
sure.
You know, but there were so many more of them. People like Henry Bibb, who published a newspaper called Voice of the Fugitive from Canada, and others who spoke and wrote against slavery, both in this country and abroad. And they were really able to bring a kind of authenticity to the movement. They really responded to the slaveholders' charge that abolitionists knew nothing about what they were talking, because these were people who had lived through and escaped slavery and could really talk about its horrors in a way that many white abolitionists could not.
So let me ask the historian a question that I am so often told that historians hate, and that is about the future. So what is where are we when it comes to an authenticity of the movement now when we look at the result of what you are writing about and the ongoing issues of racial inequality in our country?
That's another very good and big question, actually.
Sure, huge.
It is a huge question. And, you know, I think the abolitionists identified one of the central problematics of American democracy, and that was entrenched racial injustice. So when they started their movement, they were not just talking about ending slavery, but they were also talking about black citizenship rights. Some of them were even advocating the redistribution of land, what we would today call reparations. You know, Garrison often said that if anyone was owed compensation, it was not the slaveholders, it was the slaves for years of unpaid labor. And you can see these issues coming up today again. Now, the abolitionist struggle for an interracial democracy and the struggle to address very entrenched problems of both economic and racial injustice, you know, briefly triumphed during Reconstruction until it was overthrown by a systematic campaign of violence in the South. And what one has to realize that American democracy and our notions of freedom do not just progress continuously on their own, that this is a very contested thing. And throughout American history, you can see these contending forces. And it's not as if the abolitionists won in terms of destroying slavery and then that somehow that victory was complete, because we know, of course, that after Reconstruction is overthrown, you have another long racial nightmare of Jim Crow, lynching, debt peonage, convict labor, you know, all the things that we live with today. So in terms of activism today, I think what we can learn from the abolitionists is, and I think this is especially true of movements like Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street, is this attempt to constantly push at the boundaries of American democracy to address these problems. So for instance, I found it fascinating that the abolitionists were already talking about the criminalization of blackness in this country, looking at the fugitive slave laws and seeing how every black person was suspect because over 90% of black people were enslaved before the Civil War. So you can see those issues. You know, the use of issues of even what we would call today police brutality in terms of rendition of fugitive slaves and how they were hauled and beaten sometimes and arbitrarily taken down south without any due process of law. Those are the issues I think that the abolitionists have bequeathed us in terms of an ongoing struggle for human rights and an ongoing call to activism. I think that is what we can really learn from them today.
And that ongoing, I guess, brings to mind that it will always in some way be a fight, right?
Yes, because remember, these people are fighting against something. And if you look at what the abolitionists are fighting against, you know, you have the Three-Fifths Clause in the U.S. Constitution. You have the Fugitive Slave Clause in the U.S. Constitution. You have slaveholders who dominated the federal government through much of the Young Republic's history. So they were fighting against long odds. And even today, you know, I just read a report that nearly a third or more of supporters of the leading Republican candidates for the presidency today feel that Lincoln should not have abolished slavery. I was rather shocked as a historian to see that result. I think people will always try to narrow, I think, definitions of American freedom and democracy in ways that are very problematic even today. So I don't think activists today are fighting against, you know, they're not fighting in a void. They will always have opponents. This notion that American freedom and democracy is always contested, I think, is something that we could all sort of learn from history.
So this is what's scary to me, is that in what you have just described in that statistic is then the candidate who those same people support. And we see, and I hold it up to you if you haven't seen it, which is the New York Daily News cover, which says Trump for president and shows a man in a KKK hood with an ex-KKK leader saying vote for Donald Trump because he's just like us. That to me is of great concern.
Absolutely. I think it's so troubling, especially if you think of something like the Charleston massacre last year, the fact that people are now at the AME church. And of course, I talk a lot about the founders of that church,
yes,
but they were leading black abolitionists in the late 18th century. But what is shocking to me is that if you look at the Republican Party today and its base in the states that were part of the Confederacy, you know, states where Lincoln did not get a single electoral vote. It is to me shocking that those sentiments continue to hold sway. I think they are being challenged. And certainly President Obama's election, I think that this whole idea of take our country back, it sounds very bizarre to me. I think that people realize that this is something that you need to contend for. But the fact that these kind of very, one would say, almost anachronistic, rigid ideas about race continue to prevail is, I think, shocking. And I think it's a failure of historians. I think we need to, as historians, and that's one of the reasons I think I wrote this book, we as historians need to tell the story of American history. I mean, how would an average voter in the South feel today if they knew that they are voting in a certain way and that somehow their vote is connected to this very, very tragic and bad past? Maybe some of them know this, but I'm sure there are a lot who just, you know, follow it, follow certain ideas without really being aware of the history behind their political stances.
So, and I'm coming right out of reading your book. So this is why this has troubled me so. So you let me know whether what my thinking here is unfounded or is overreactionary. Mm-hmm. But what I see happening, and maybe it's only a blip, I don't know. But with this emergence of a voice or voices, it seems to give rise and allow these thoughts that have been muted for a long time to become louder and to become unmuted. And I wonder that, do we quickly go back to the very shallow ground that we proceeded, the progress that we made, or do we really take a few steps back?
You know, I think when people talk about these things today, sometimes they do it virtually in code, the language that they use.
Right.
I think they're
but
very
the code seems to be working.
The
people
code
seems
is,
to be breaking the code.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly somebody like Trump doesn't seem to have much filter in terms of what he says. And that alarms other Republicans, I think. But, you know, I don't want to, at the same time, minimize what has been achieved. You know, I don't want to minimize the fact that indeed, slavery was destroyed,
right,
that Jim Crow was dismantled,
yes,
that this country did manage to elect its first black president. But I think every time you have those kinds of achievements, you have this amazing backlash from groups and people who either identify with a certain side of American history or who use those kinds of codes, like we are for states' rights. You know, what does that mean today? It's a cause that, you know, slaveholders use to defend slavery, segregationists use to defend segregation. So when you say that this is your constitutional position, you're actually saying something in code in terms of what your views are about race and citizenship in this country. And I think as long as historians continue to unpack that for ordinary American citizens to really understand that, you know, this is what this tradition is associated with, I think we'd have done our job.
The Confederate flag is a code. Don't tread on me flag is a code.
I mean, the Confederate flag, to me, stands for slavery.
Yeah.
Nothing else. And if you read all the declarations of secession of all the Southern states, you know that. And the fact that, you know, white supremacists all over the world use it as a symbol of racial superiority should you know, send a signal to those people who claim that it is some sort of benign symbol of Southern heritage.
Well, if only we could make a law that everybody should read your book. it's The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. It is published by Yale University Press. It is eye-opening, and I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Manisha Sinha is the author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. The book is published by Yale University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.